I'm Laura Vinroot-Poole. For over 20 years, I've owned Capital, an internationally recognized specialty store in Charlotte, North Carolina. On this podcast, we unlock the stories of people's lives through the stories of what they wore. These aren't conversations about fashion. These are conversations about people. Tawny Goodman is a legend in the fashion industry. She's responsible for some of the most striking fashion images in the past 20 years and has worked with some of the industry's most iconic personalities, from Diana Vreeland to Anna Wintour. We hosted Tawny at a book signing at our Los Angeles location this summer. I love spending the morning with Tawny to learn more about her childhood and the incredible career she so generously shares in her new retrospective, Point of View. Tawny Goodman, I'm so glad you're here in California.
I am so pleased to be here. It's a real treat.
So last night you were at the Getty?
I was at the Getty. My first time. I hate to admit it, but you know, after all of these years, it's the first time that I've been to the Getty.
And what'd you think?
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
Just so fabulous and wonderful. And the spirit of it and the fact that all the people are out on the lawn and their kids and it is free and it is open. It has so much to offer. It was fabulous.
And you're promoting your new book, Point of View?
Yes.
Tell me what your first fashion memory was as a child.
I think that my first fashion memory was definitely of my mother. She was very beautiful. She still is. She's 98 now.
Wow.
You know, these were the days where she dressed to go to the bank, right down to gloves,
yep,
properly. And she had a blue, like a sky blue boucle suit, slim skirt, fitted jacket. I think it even had maybe a Nehru collar or something, mm-hmm, gold buttons. And the lining of it was shocking bright emerald green silk.
God. Oh.
And I just loved the fact that it was the surprise. Nobody saw.
Right.
You know, she was buttoned up to the top. So nobody ever saw the lining, but it was there.
Yeah.
And that was probably one of the first kind of fascination of fashion for me, I think. Probably.
Where did she get it?
I think she may have had it made.
Okay.
She had a dressmaker named Ami, uh-huh, on Madison Avenue, and Ami used to... So, Mommy, in other words, she picked the lining.
Yeah.
That was my mother.
Exactly.
Yeah. That was my mother.
And your father was a dresser, too?
My father was very elegant.
Yeah.
And actually, somebody said to me the other day about who did I think influenced me the most, my mother or my father, and it was obviously my mother. But then I thought, you know, now that I'm getting older and I'm wearing more... You know, I'm always wearing pants now and, a tailored jacket that has got an inside pocket, which is a man's jacket.
Yeah.
But the inside pocket is really important. You need that to,
yeah,
put your things in. I am actually dressing a lot like my father.
The only thing I can't get used to, we have a men's store and I'm their best female customer. But the only thing I can't get used to is the opposite buttoning. You know, men's jackets button on the opposite direction, I think.
Yes, they do. And you know why, right?
No,
you know
tell
what
me
it
why.
Is? They button because of drawing the sword. So
really?
When it buttons over the right, because when you drew your sword, you would not get caught on the jacket.
I love that so much.
That's true.
and they dress for dinner, I think.
They dress for dinner. Did you girls
and boy dress for dinner? You have two sisters and a brother.
Two sisters and a brother. We all went to, school. We'd come home from school in our uniforms, so we didn't have to worry about dressing at all.
Yeah.
I mean, uniforms kind of are the great equalizer.
I think so.
I think they're kind of a godsend, really, in a school environment.
I do, too.
My parents, it was very informal, but it was formal. I mean, we all went to the dinner table together. We all sat together. Mummy changed into a long skirt. And it was, once again, it was her design. It was a circle skirt, so it had a lot of volume to it. No seams, no nothing. That was made out of red felt.
Mm.
Not wool or,
mm-hmm,
but felt.
Hmm.
And it was a great color of red. It was sort of a tomato red. It had a lot of orange in it. And then she would simply put on a little cashmere sweater and, you know, she'd have her pearls on, put a belt on. And that's what she wore all the time. And Daddy actually changed out of his jacket, his suit jacket, and into a smoking jacket. I mean, it sounds so pretentious, but it really wasn't, because it was a signal that they had departed from their daily life and were now joining us. And they were imposing a certain amount of formality,
decorum,
which I think was a good discipline in a way. And it also taught us that manners are graciousness. That's the point of having manners, is that you can be gracious and generous with other people.
Exactly.
And, you know, it's something I certainly tried to teach my children.
Did y'all sit down for dinner?
I really tried. I was a single mom from the age of, Evie was 2.5, I guess. And so I really tried, but I traveled a lot.
It's hard.
It is hard, but you'd be surprised. I mean, we had lots of fascinating things to tell my parents, I'm sure, that were absolutely nothing. But it was, it was expressing interest in one another.
Yes.
And that's communication, of course, which is the most vital part of life.
In your book, you talked about your mother not making her life separate from yours, and that she took y'all, when she wanted to go to the museum, it wasn't because she wanted to take you, she wanted to go and y'all came along with her if she wanted to paint in the park. How did that inform your creativity?
I think the inclusion that Mummy had of her family, she gave up her career as a textile designer. Mm-hmm. She had 4 children in 6 years, and she really devoted herself to her family. And the devotion was an entirety. So she was also devoted to the arts. She was devoted to all of the creative arts. And she had friends that were in the arts. So we had a full exposure.
Yeah.
And we were always part of, the dinner party. We would say hi to the guests, and we would, pass the crudités. And, we were good little soldiers. But we were exposed to artists right from the start.
So you went to Brearley, and you talked about the uniforms. Did you make your uniforms more punk, or how did you handle that?
Well, it was part of the punk. It was hippie, so it was not punk. But yes, of course we did. We were, I graduated in 1970, so, I was, 15 in 1968, which was a very pivotal year, of course. So we were very engaged with all of that, too. And, this was a moment of a kind of explosion of freedom of expression. So, I think I was one of the original goths, if you ask Wendy, if you ask my sister Wendy, because I got very enamored with mascara, and I never took it off. I had layers of mascara on. And Wendy and I shared a room, and she would just take a look at the pillow when I got up in the morning, and she would just say, "Tani, don't you think it's about time that you just refreshed it a little bit?" It was quite goth, actually.
I love it.
Mm-hmm.
And Wendy says that your big sort of punk moment, or your standout first real fashion moment, was when you had your hair cut by Vidal Sassoon.
Yeah. Well, it wasn't the famous one that Peggy Moffat had that was very symmetrical. It was the asymmetrical one. So it was like really...
Oh, wow.
You always had your head kind of cocked to one side to accommodate getting... It was weighted that way, actually. And it was, I had a full mouth of braces. This was not a pretty picture. And I was really skinny. But I was out there, it wasn't about beauty. It was about kind of the dare.
Yeah.
I guess that's what I was gravitating to at that point.
And then started modeling.
I started modeling as a lark in the summer of 10th grade because I was looking for a summer job. And Leo Lerman, who was the editor-in-chief of Mademoiselle magazine, was a friend of my parents. Mm-hmm. And I went to see Leo and I said, can I just have, be an intern for the summer? And he said, well, we don't have anything like that to offer you, but you're tall and skinny. Why don't you see do you want to try modeling? So I thought, oh, well, yeah, of course. And he sent me around and I did tests, and I started to photograph with one of their very, very good photographers, David McCabe, and his pictures are in the book. It was a summer job. And then I went back to...
It's not a fun job.
Yeah, summer modeling job. And then I went back to school, and I decided to take a year off between high school and art school and try it again. Mm-hmm. And then I did do it for a year.
Finished art school and then went on to work with Diana Vreeland at the Met.
Yeah. Well, I didn't finish art school. I dropped out of art school. So I went, when I was in art school, I spent a year in Italy. Mm-hmm. Doing, one of the exchanges, you spend it. But then I came back. I was supposed to resume my studies at Philadelphia College of Art and did not.
Yeah.
So I was back in the city. I actually did not. I wasn't happy in Philadelphia.
Because you wanted to get back to New York, or just...
No, because I had been very discouraged. I had an art teacher who said to me, you're never going to be an artist. And I thought, I was in the freshman year. I was just starting out, and I was having a very remarkable exposure compared to what I was used to at Brearley in
right.
the city, and with a lot of cultural exposure, but it was a very safe exposure because I was with my parents and there had been a certain curation as to what I was seeing. When I got to Philadelphia, one of the first kind of evening visiting artists was Vito Acconci, who showed a film of himself in Super 8, you know, very grainy Super 8, and the film was of him walking towards the camera, walking away from the camera, walking towards the camera, walking away from the camera, stark naked. He had his penis tucked between his legs. And then it moved on to him burning wax, you know, a candle with wax burning onto his chest. And I just thought, it was fabulous. It was really fabulous because I didn't...
Sounds like a runway
show. Was, once again, it was freedom of expression and license. You know, you do have license to think independently and differently, totally differently. It was really revelatory for me. But it was a huge challenge. I didn't know what to do with it. And this teacher, Harry Sobiak, identified it. And he said, your taste is too good. You are not going to let go of your good taste. It has been, it's part of your DNA. You've been ingrained with it. And it's going to keep you from ever getting past it into something else, which was a really interesting observation.
It's very interesting. But and probably a lot of truth to it. What do you, and it made you mad then. What do you think about it now?
Well, I wonder what would have happened if I hadn't listened to him.
Right.
You know, I mean, I was very intimidated. I really was frightened and, you know, I was mortified because I was trying so hard. And part of the effort was using my good taste.
But I also think that it's so funny that you really have become, I mean, you became one of the great artists of our time. I mean, in a different medium. I mean, it wasn't a medium that existed then almost. Will you tell me about Diana Vreeland and that experience? And you had an interesting cast of characters that worked with you.
Well, she came to the Met through Thomas Hoving, and he was fabulous. He was the director of the museum then, and she had just been fired from Vogue.
Right.
And it was brutal. And he swooped down, brought her to the Met, and had a fabulous idea, which was, let's marry two cultures, one which was a very traditional culture, mm-hmm. and one that was a very flamboyant culture. And she came in, she opened up the Costume Institute, and, you know, nobody even knew that it was there practically.
But it was there?
It was there. It was there, and it had a very extensive collection, and everything was climate-controlled and beautiful vaults, and it was very, very carefully curated and very well taken care of.
And always in the basement?
And always in the basement.
Yeah.
And Stella Blum was the curator. And, you know, she was kind of railroaded by Diana Vreeland, who came in and was, you know, her irreverence was what took it out of the basement.
Mm-hmm.
So that people really saw it as another way of expression. Again, once again, it's communication and mm-hmm. expression. And she, her audacity was the thing that was so intriguing for people, I think. And it made it very approachable at the same time.
Right. And Andre, you worked with Andre?
Andre Leontali.
From North Carolina.
Was there. We were all there. We were...
Fernando Sanchez.
Fernando Sanchez.
Georgia
Santangelo.
Yeah.
Oh, there were a lot of us.
Yeah.
You know, I was a stayer. I stuck in there for 4 years, but a lot of them were transient.
Right.
You know, they came and went.
What do you remember the most about her?
You know, her demeanor, for starters, was so extraordinary that you were in a presence right away.
Was she tall?
No, she was not tall.
She just had a big personality.
She was petite. And the picture in the book, I think, really does, you know, tell a lot because she's the gesture. It's all about that finger pointing. And that finger pointing really told you a lot without any words necessary whatsoever. Her impatience was a strength because it made you not second guess. If you made the wrong turn, then you take a turn away from it and make it a better turn. Mm-hmm. And that kind of confidence, you don't have the confidence, but you're forced into being confident with the gesture. Eventually, you learn to trust it.
Right, which was so important to you in your career.
Mm-hmm.
And then you moved on to Anne Klein, Calvin Klein.
I mean, before that, you have to remember I worked with, you know, I went from working at the Met to working at the New York Times with Gary Donovan.
Right.
My first photo shoot was with Helmut Newton. Talk about, you know, hit the ground running. Then from there, I went freelance. And from there, I went to Calvin Klein, where when I landed at Calvin's, you know, I was really instantly at home,
yeah,
because it was a sensibility. His discipline and precision was really appealed to me. So
yeah,
it was a very, very good match for me. But it was...
But that was a different title, too. I mean, it was a totally different thing than you'd done before, correct?
Yeah. Well, I was advertising.
Advertising.
I mean, I, you know,
yeah,
I was
okay.
Vice president of advertising, but I was really just the stylist, essentially,
right,
on the advertising.
And during a really seminal, important time.
Yeah. Where it was very, you know, the advertising was very focused, but it was very much, I was really in that mindset, the Calvin Klein mindset the whole time, which I was very, very comfortable in.
Yeah.
But then when Liz came to America to take over Harper's Bazaar from British Vogue, they brought her over from British Vogue, it was all of a sudden I had all of the playground to play in.
Yeah.
I wasn't just in the Calvin Klein sandbox,
right,
which I loved
being
in. But all of the other things came into play, and that's really when, you know, I got on the boat. The first shoot that I did was at the Louis Kahn Center for British Art, I think at Yale. And in those days, you did all the production yourself. So I had to, you know, find somebody at Yale who would let a fashion group come in and take a picture. And that, you know, all of a sudden I could do anything that I wanted to do because that's the way Liz wanted it done. She picked the people that worked on the magazine with her to do what, she trusted what they stood for. And she wanted them to go out and do what they felt best doing.
One of the things I really loved was when you talked about your personal life kind of morphing into the pictures, and Christy Turlington often playing your mother.
Well, the pictures that we did of Christy at Cooper Union, which is where Mummy went to art school.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
So we went right into the studios that Mummy must have been in, and Christy does look a lot like my mother then. And she was wearing very simple clothes, and her hair was pulled back in not exactly the chignon that my mother used to wear all the time, but close enough. And she really represented a very understated elegance that really was my mother's
essence.
Exactly. Thank
you. So can you talk to me a little bit about when inspiration of that, and is it something that, I mean, do you have notebooks where you write down memories or ideas? And I think for me, the thing that's really fascinating about it is how that coincides with the collections. Just because from what I know from seeing the collections, you know, you don't always find all the things you want to find.
Mm-hmm.
So does the idea come first, or do the collections come first and they remind you of something? And then how does it happen, and how far in advance does it happen? I mean, I'm so fascinated by that part.
Well, I mean, it is systematic. You know, you do have an outline that you have to work with.
Right.
And the outline is the collections.
Right.
Because you're introducing the reader to the upcoming collections. At Vogue, at Bazaar, it was different because we all were satellites of our own interests, and we would approach the collections picking what fed our interests.
So when you're at the show, you're making notes of things.
Yeah.
That,
okay. Yeah. Or you see something, you think, oh my God, that's, you know, fantastic. Yeah. And wouldn't it be great, you know, here or there.
And by the way, back when you started that, there were no cell phones. So how are are you drawing a picture of it?
You're drawing a picture.
Yeah.
And
are you remembering it's look number 47?
Yeah. You do is you draw the picture and then you go back to the showroom and you see it in real life and you can sketch it some more. But because I could draw, made sketch notes, but other editors write word notes.
Interesting. Do you have the journals that you have?
I do. I have
some
of them. And I have a whole stack of them, and I keep on thinking, am I just going to ditch these things, or should I keep them, or what should I do with them? And
do they look do you like the way they look when you flip through them?
Sort of. You know, they're okay. They're not, you know, they're working sketches, so...
So at Vogue, you produced over 186 covers, which sounds incredible.
And counting. I'm doing
counting.
Another one tomorrow, next week.
In 2 days.
Yeah.
Is there one that has been the most meaningful for you, or one that stands out as...
Well, the First Lady, of course.
Yeah.
I mean, she, you know, the experience was, you know, I mean, it was a moment of such triumphant hope for this country, and to be with her and to meet him was, you know, beyond words, really.
And there's so many variables around a shoot like that. Does she try on the clothes beforehand?
Well, you have to work very specifically with her. She had she has a stylist that works with her.
Right.
I wish I could remember Meredith's last name because she's incredible. So I worked very closely with Meredith, and then Meredith would take it in. I was not doing a fitting with her. It was, you know, Meredith would do the fitting with her.
And Meredith would say she feels more comfortable in this sort of silhouette, this color, this fabric.
Yeah, there was a lot of communication beforehand.
And also, is that communicated to Anna or to, or is it, I mean, all of that is communicated the whole time?
Yeah, everybody's in conversation the whole time.
I mean, are there many alternatives in the shoot itself? You don't go with just one dress.
No. You have a lot of options.
Do you know when you're in it, which one's going to make it almost all the time?
You have a pretty good idea. I mean, you've done so much homework. You've done so much kind of mental and visual and technical preparation for it that you have a pretty good idea in a circumstance like that where there is a lot of control and there's a lot of timing control that you do have a pretty good sense of what's going to
The other
work.
Question is about the photographer itself. Do you, before that, too, are you thinking about that the photographer's style? Like if you're working with Steven Meisel or something, it's going to be a different sort of a picture than it is with Annie. Like, and do you
totally.
And you're thinking that beforehand that she's probably going to do it this way or he's probably going to do it this way. And so these are the clothes that would probably relate more.
Yes. I mean, it is, when you talk about a photograph representing a collaboration, that is what it is. It's the exchange. Everyone is sensitive to.
And makeup and hair as well. Yeah.
Exactly. The whole team is brought together with all of their strengths intact. I mean, that's what you do. So you're not going to give a dress to Annie Leibovitz that she's not going to understand.
Right.
There would be no point.
Right.
There would just be no point. And you're not going to give a big boring something or other or a very, well, not big boring, I'm going to put it that way, but something you don't think would excite Steven Meisel or Steven Klein.
One of the things you've said to me, you said recently in Charlotte, was to trust mistakes, which I loved so much because I'd never heard it that simply. You know, it's always, you always hear sort of like a longer version of that, but trust mistakes was just, I thought, the clearest and best.
Well, it's such a good lesson because, you know, they come at you all the time.
Yeah.
you can't escape them. They just come at you. And if you don't dodge them, but you embrace them, then you can be so wonderfully surprised by what comes next.
Yeah.
And that kind of is life. You know, life does throw some zingers and you have to be prepared for what, you know, will come next.
Can you remember a favorite mistake that happened that turned out beautifully? On a cover or?
Well, I mean, one of the ones that is a famous citation is the picture of Amber with the car up on the sidewalk.
Right.
Because that shoot was, we went to Poughkeepsie, New York, specifically for one location that had to do with the train station. And at the very last minute, once we got up there and we were all encamped in this hotel, that we didn't get the permission to do it. And so we were all sitting there thinking, you know, we had clothes that were quite specific. They didn't translate. You know, they were quite conservative. It was a suit story. And then all of a sudden, these cars came rumbling down the main stream, and we saw one after the other. It was a whole convention, I guess, of these cars. And it was just like jaw-dropping, literally.
Did you run out into the street and stop it?
Yes, we did. We did. We literally just said, there's the chute right there. And, you know, it was Stephen that got the car up on the sidewalk. But we were in Poughkeepsie, so the sidewalk was so inviting.
Yeah.
You know, it was this big, wide sidewalk, and there was the bank vault, and it was just, it all came together.
Amazing.
And that gremlin, which does show up often on the set, sometimes with malintent, sometimes with good intent, was really with us on that shoot.
I love that. The other thing that was really remarkable to me, looking at all of the covers, was how the industry went, you could really see it physically going from model-driven to celebrity-driven.
Mm-hmm.
What has that been like, and how did that affect your work?
Well, it happened overnight. I mean, it's kind of overnight. It started to happen at Harper's Bazaar. You started to see the celebrities take hold. And then the first year that I was at Vogue, it was all, the girls were still reigning up the covers. I think that the first celebrity cover I did was actually Marion Jones.
Huh.
The Olympic field star.
Track and field, yeah.
Yeah, track and field. Mm-hmm. And then it became kind of practically magical because you all of a sudden had a whole new audience that was picking up the magazine. A lot of the magazine was newsstand sales at that point.
Right.
And so you didn't just have the fashion interests picking up the magazine, you had the celebrity interests, and you had somebody who was watching a movie that was about to come out, and Julia Roberts was about to be in this. And, you know, so you had a whole new group that you were addressing.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a success right away.
Right.
So it became the way to do it. So the second year that I worked on the covers, I think that there was one or two models, and the rest of, you know, it was a very quick change.
How did that change your job?
Well, you don't have, first of all, you don't have a you know, expert colleague with you,
right,
which is the model, because the girls,
right,
are amazing.
Yeah.
And, you know, they are with you every step of the way and are so much a part of the decision and the process of
the
making
collaboration.
The collaboration,
yeah,
of the photograph. So you have, you know, you have a whole different set of characters. You have the agents and you have the PRs and you have the personality of the celebrity themselves and you have the fit, a fit question, of course. And you have a kind of integrity that involves bringing the celebrity to Vogue, to what Vogue represents,
mm-hmm,
and Vogue coming to what the celebrity represents.
Right.
And they can be quite different.
Yes.
So the marriage is interesting. And it is, I think it's been very successful.
You have recently moved to be a contributing editor, and mm-hmm, you've talked about that was scary at first.
I've been so fortunate because I've landed in places that really were home to me.
I mean,
Calvin Klein was definitely home to me. Harper's Bazaar was definitely home to me. And so was Vogue. I mean, Vogue, I'm very much a Vogue girl. I share a lot of the DNA of the brand.
Mm-hmm.
And the brand has evolved and is changing the way everything is changing today. Having kind of the reinforcement that you have when you are literally part of it, to the extent that I was as the fashion director for almost 20 years,
mm-hmm,
and having that change. I mean, I still am at Vogue. I'm still in the meetings. I'm still there.
Mm-hmm.
But it's forcing me to think about what's next.
And what is interesting? What's looking interesting to you?
Well, I would really like to work. I think that what the fashion industry is addressing today, where everyone is addressing it, is sustainability and how,
yeah,
we're going to go forward producing simply everything on the earth, not,
right,
just what we're going to wear.
Right.
And I would be very interested in working in you know, any capacity, mm-hmm, with a designer or a company or, you know, I've been to the Copenhagen Summit for 2 years,
mm-hmm,
and there's a lot of very positive developments,
yeah,
and I just think they need to be encouraged.
Vogue seems like an incredible place, but for 20 years to work there, I think you probably didn't have a lot of space to think about anything else.
Mm-hmm.
And so it may be scary, but also really exciting to have that opening. To,
yes,
even think about. I mean, I'm sure you haven't even had the minute to think about what you would want to do for 20 years.
Yeah, no. I mean, you was busy.
You
were always busy at Vogue. You always had, you know, your hands full.
How did you manage being a working mother? Did you have people along the way that showed you that, or was it just your mother?
I think that one of the things that I was very fortunate to get, however I got it, was the work ethic.
Yeah.
And that, you know, Mrs. Vreeland absolutely enforced that and encouraged it, but I already had it. That's why that plug-in was so easy for me. It was such a good fit. And I think that probably came from my mother. Mm-hmm. I never saw mommy idle, ever.
Yeah.
She always was doing something that she was engaged in and that she obviously was interested in and that she was tireless doing. And it's one thing I've always said to my children, I hope they have heard it, which is I have never been bored. Because there's always something that you can do,
yeah,
that is a wonderful thing to do, which sounds kind of like, you know, naff, but there is truth to it. I think that, you know, once again, it is being a mother, a working mother is a challenge. There's no question to it. I remember when I had Evie thinking that I am inventing time. It was so interesting because, you know, you have this day that is jam-packed, and then all of a sudden you need to take 20 minutes out to nurse.
Yes.
Do you remember this?
Yes, I do.
And it was like, wait a minute, where am I going to get this 20 minutes? You invent the time.
Yeah.
It was crazy. And I just thought it was kind of miraculous. But the whole process of having children is miraculous.
Yes.
I mean, you're a walking miracle. You're walking around as a miracle, and you just are overwhelmed by it. And I was so fortunate to have my children. I really knew how lucky I was because I was 40 when I had Cole. And at that time, you know, he's in his 20s now. I was considered high risk. Today,
right,
it is absolutely not high risk.
Right.
I was really, really, really fortunate, and I knew it. And every, you know, moment of being able to just have it be part of me
yeah.
was sacred. So, you know, no matter how, you know, I used to get a freezer put in my hotel room, and I used to freeze the milk and bring it back with dry ice into a chest into America. And the customs guys would stop me and they'd say, what's in the chest? And I'd say, well, actually, it's mother's milk. And they never even questioned it. They never looked beyond that answer.
Tawny, when do you feel like you're at your best?
The answer sounds incredibly obnoxious, but absolutely it's true. I'm at my best when I'm doing things for other people.
Yeah.
I find that it is more fun to put together, to surprise somebody or to think about something that they, you know, you remember that they liked. I particularly like to do it for my children and my family. But it's fun. There's a fun factor to that. And I think that is when I'm at my best.
Is there something that people don't know about you that you wish they did?
I love to cook.
I do
love to cook. I love to cook.
I love to cook too.
And I love to go to the farmer's market, and I love everything organic. You know, don't forget I was a hippie from the start. So I have been doing this for many, many years, and I, you know, take my little compostables to the farmer's market 3 times a week, 4 times a week, and I, you know, take all my little rinds and bits of things, and I find it very satisfying because we all should be doing it. You know, I mean, again, it sounds so obnoxious, but there is a great satisfaction to even a small step today, especially with whatever, if everybody, you know, it's the old cliche, if everybody did a little bit of something, it would amount to a lot.
Was there a game-changing moment in your life?
I think a big game-changer for me was getting sick and becoming a single mom. I am not unique. You know, it has happened to so many people, and I have been enormously lucky because it's 20 years later. Mm-hmm. But it really teaches you how to live. It's as simple as it is, right? There are certain things you have to do when you have children. Your responsibility is to the children. I remember thinking that when I was diagnosed and I, you know, went through surgery and all of that stuff and, you know, went through chemotherapy and the whole bit, I'm thinking, you know, I'm absolutely not dying. I have two children, and there's no way that I'm going to die. That's just not going to happen.
That sounds like your mom, too, that sort of too busy, too many things.
So, but, you know, it's scary. And then you learn from that, and you actually, you know, it is a way of appreciation that that is beyond description, because you just are so appreciative to be with your children.
We ask everybody on the podcast what they wore to prom. Did Brearley have a prom?
Brearley did not really have a prom.
Did you go to a prom?
Well, you know, Brearley was an all-girls school.
Yes.
And our brother's school was collegiate.
Yeah.
I wonder if I even went to the prom. I think there was the Goddard Gaieties, right? There was something called the Goddard Gaieties.
And what did you wear?
I wore some snappy little thing. You know, I was into fashion at that point.
Into it?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, because of the uniform? Because there were so few instances where you could actually wear
something of your choice. Well, no, but don't forget, we broke the uniform code.
Your whole class did?
We were the class that broke the uniform code. You know, we were the rebels. We got into trouble all the time. I went from the uniform to a pair of blue wide whale corduroy pants that I never took off.
I love wide whales.
And, you know, I was into fashion at that point, absolutely. I mean, I was modeling, so I was totally into fashion.
Yeah. Do you love fashion now?
I do.
For yourself?
Well, for myself, I've made it very easy for myself. You know, it's a bit of a...
Uniform.
It's a it's back to a uniform. It just makes it easier.
I know.
You know, you're busy, you have other things to do, and I just think it's easier.
Thank you so, so, so much.
Well, it's a pleasure. I must say, it's a real pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Make sure to pick up a copy of Tawny's new book at Diesel Bookstore in the Brentwood Country Mart. What We Wore is produced by Capital and Balto Creative Media. The original song, Someone So Enchanting, was composed and performed by Britt Drozda. What We Wore is a member of the Queen City Podcast Network, powered by Ortho Carolina. Find out more at queencitypodcastnetwork.com.